This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is useful.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mates, a podcast that follows our journey of investing. We break down the world of investing from beginning to dividend so that you can hopefully make some returns. My name is Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How's it going, bro?
I'm very good, Bryce. Looking forward to this episode. We are hearing from, I guess you could say, one of our white whales, an investor that we've been chasing and haven't managed to get him on the show yet. Unfortunately, we still haven't managed to get him in the studio, but we will be hearing from him.
We will be hearing from him, Ren. You're right. That is Hamish Douglas, perhaps the most informed and hottest fund manager in Australia at the moment. We would love to get him on the show at some point. And I have faith in you and I, Ren, that at some point we will get Hamish on Equity Mates.
I'm pretty confident that if we just keep complaining enough on the show, eventually we'll make it happen.
Until then, we are going to hear from him today from an interview that he did with one of the general managers at Magellan, which is the fund manager that he helped set up, Magellan Asset Management, where he is currently the chief investment officer. Earlier in the week, he did a live webinar called What Really Matters. And, you know, having the ability to hear from Hamish for about an hour was pretty interesting. Alec and I managed to sit down and have a listen. So we thought we would share it with you guys, Ren.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole point of Equity Mates is to try and bring the markets to the everyday investor. And we'll try and do that through any way we can, even reproducing interviews if we think they're good quality and people can learn a lot from them. For me, I found it particularly interesting for a few reasons. There's obviously a lot of topical stuff going on with markets at the moment, probably none bigger than the US election. And I found Hamish's discussion of what the US election will mean for markets quite informative. And then Magellan obviously has some holdings in China. When we spoke to Chris Weldon from Magellan, he spoke about their investment in Tencent. I enjoyed Hamish's discussion of the Chinese market and in particular Alibaba, the Chinese e-commerce giant, and also Ant Financial that's being spun out of Alibaba. So for me, there was some interesting macro things around the US election and then also some company-specific things that I found quite interesting.
Yeah, it was a fascinating conversation, Ren. You're right. Hearing from Hamish is pretty special. And we've been fortunate enough to speak with Chris Weldon, who is his, I guess, right-hand man over at Magellan, leading the high conviction fund. There's just such great quality coming out of Magellan. I was particularly interested in Hamish's comments around the ongoing impact of COVID and how markets are really looking at the race for a vaccine and how that's sort of going to play out. So a lot to digest in this interview, but to your point, Ren, Equity Mates is all about making markets as accessible as possible. So whilst we can't have Hamish in the room with us, this is the next best thing. And we would encourage you all to actually go and check out the Magellan website. They've got a pretty comprehensive insights section on their website full of fantastic pieces of information to help you on your investing journey. So we thankfully had permission from Magellan to play this for you today. So we very much hope you enjoyed it as much as we did.
Yeah. Now, before we get in, we should ground it in its timing. So Hamish did this interview on Tuesday, the 13th of October. So if he speaks about any particular prices or, you know, anything like that, just remember that that's when this interview was done.
Nice. Well, we'll leave it with you and Hamish, and looking forward to finally getting him in the room at some stage.
Yeah.
So welcome everyone to this live Magellan webinar with our CIO and chairman, Hamish Douglas. We've got over 6,000 registered to attend this this live webinar, and we've still got people logging in as we are going live. So thank you to the advisors, the stockbrokers, the unit holders, the shareholders, and media that have joined this Zoominar here today. And hopefully everyone's staying safe during this ongoing pandemic. And a special call out to our Victorian friends. We are thinking of you. We have our disclaimer on screen now. Hopefully you've all had a chance to read it. That's good. Hamish, we've literally had hundreds of questions that have been pre-submitted. Well over 300, I think. But the two that really do stand out are very much around the US election and COVID-19. So let's open up with addressing those two in particular. First up, we're about 2 weeks out from the US elections. From an investment perspective, how should we be thinking about the impact of that US election?
Oh, well, thank you, Frank. And I'd like to join with you in thanking everyone for joining us today. It's great we can all do this by Zoom. It'll be nice when we can get together in person. And also to all our friends in Victoria, we hope everything opens up fairly shortly, but you look like you're in you're on track now, which is very good to see. The US elections, Frank, I hadn't noticed that there was a US election on, and you're asking a very important question around investment perspective, but I can't answer the investment perspective without actually talking a little bit about the election itself. If we look at the race for the White House, Biden looks to be clearly in front at the moment. He's got a 10% plus lead in the national opinion polls, and a 3 to 4% lead in the key sort of battleground or marginal states. The betting markets have a probability of sort of 80% plus that Biden will take the White House. But if we go back to 2016, 3 to 4 weeks out, Clinton had a 7% national poll lead and had a lead in each of these key battleground states. And this was at the same time that the Ask Hollywood tapes had been released, where Trump had made some, you know, some very disparaging comments around around women, and everyone said it was a layup that Clinton was going to win that election. And then what happened, sort of 2 weeks out from the election, the FBI under Comey reopened that email saga, and the polls started to turn on Clinton. And so what I'm saying is, anything can happen. Clinton looked this far out that she was clearly in the lead. Biden looks clearly he's in the lead, but anything can happen from 2016. But I think it would take a real surprise from here. You really know where the White House is going to be won. You can follow where Trump is going. And this week he's headed to Florida. He was there on Monday. Then he's going to Pennsylvania. Then he's going to Iowa, and I think at the end of the week he's going to North Carolina. Other key states to watch would be Michigan and Wisconsin as well, those sort of key battleground states. It's not about the national poll leads. The first thing you've asked a question on markets, you know, how markets will react to the election. The first thing you need to look at in terms of markets is the prospects for an ugly contested election where the election result just isn't called. Trump's making a big issue about voting, polling about where people are going to mail in their votes and pre-poll voting, and whether or not there's going to be fraud. There's no evidence of that, but I think that's going to be a very big issue if it's a close election. And therefore it could get very ugly post-election, and markets just don't like uncertainty. So I think we should all prepare ourselves that we could get into that situation where we don't have a result. It looks pretty ugly, and markets may well be volatile and uncertain during that period, but that will be a relatively short period. There will be an election result. From a longer-term investment perspective, what you really have to watch isn't whether Biden takes the White House. What you really have to watch is what happens in the Senate. It looks pretty likely at the moment the Democrats are going to keep the lower house, the House of Representatives. It looks at the moment, 80% probability that Biden will take the White House, but it's a much closer call of what's going to happen in the Senate race in the United States. If Biden wins the White House and the Democrats get the lower house of the House of Representatives, but the Senate stays with the Republicans, I don't think a lot's going to happen from the market's perspective, because at the end of the day, the Republicans will be able to block most sort of radical legislation that would be put through. The Senate is currently held, there's 100 seats in the US Senate. It's currently held 53 seats to the Republicans and 47 to the Democrats. It's probably closer to 54-46 because it looks like Alabama is going to go to the Republicans. It's currently held by the Democrats. That means the Democrats are going to have to win 4 Senate seats to get to 50-50. And the reason I say 4 and not 5, in the United States, if the Democrats were going to hold 50 seats and they hold the White House, the vice president actually has the casting vote on any tied vote. So 50 is enough to get control of the Senate. This season, it's a bit like Australia, 35 senators are up for election, 23 Republicans and 12 Democrats. The key races to watch are in around 5 seats. They're in Colorado, Arizona, North Carolina, Iowa and Maine. The Democrats are ahead in each of these seats. Iowa is probably the closest. It looks about a tie. It was clearly won last time around, and it's ultimately going to depend on voter turnout in these areas. And a massive amounts of money are being spent on these key Senate races. If the Democrats get the trifecta, and what I mean by the trifecta is they take the White House, they take the lower house, and they take the Senate, they're still not in a position of total control, because there's an unusual rule in the Senate in the United States called the filibuster, which means to pass ordinary legislation, you actually need to get to 60 votes to pass it without a sort of procedure that can indefinitely hold up legislation outside budgetary legislation. But the Democrats could actually change the Senate rules if they got control of the Senate, if they got 50 or more senators. And this has started to be debated. Should they get rid of this rule? It doesn't have universal support amongst all Democrats, particularly senators, for removing that rule. But I think quickly we're going to get focused, if they win this trifecta, on these Senate rules. And if it starts to become clearer that they're starting to get behind, if they win the trifecta, that they're going to change the rules in the Senate, then I think it starts to open up how markets would start to become more concerned. Would the agenda start to become more radical and more damaging for markets? So that's going to be a very interesting question. But we do have to understand, it's a bit like what happens in Australia in politics. The Democrats aren't just one single voice. It's effectively different factions. And there is a very large moderate faction in the Democrats. Biden himself comes from this moderate faction here. So even if they were to remove the filibuster, I don't think it's that likely we're going to see the radical left agenda of the Democrats coming to the fore. It just doesn't work like that, but the markets may be concerned. But overall, if Biden wins and even if the trifecta goes, we're not that concerned about a Democratic win in the United States, but expect some volatility in the immediate aftermath of the election, particularly if it's close. I think Trump will challenge the result, and of course that creates uncertainty. So expect some volatility. But overall, the outcome of the election isn't really driving our behaviour in what we're doing holistically in the portfolio. At individual stocks, it may be, but holistically, in our overall risk appetite, it's not.
Thanks, Hamish. And likewise, in case you hadn't noticed, we're well and truly into the global pandemic. You've previously suggested that its impact on the market could be anything from 50% down to 20% up. Again, from an investment perspective, what's your take on the impact of COVID?
Yeah, well, let's look at the known unknowns again. I wrote about this in the investor letter. There's still considerable uncertainty regarding a cure from COVID-19. We don't know if a vaccine will be effective. We don't know if you can get re-effective. We don't know how long immunity will last. And we're certainly starting to see some second wave of infections occurring, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere as they move into their autumn at the moment. But notwithstanding that incredible amount of uncertainty that we don't know the medical pathway out of this at the moment, there are some positives that have developed over the last few months. There has been considerable progress on vaccine trials. There's numerous vaccines in phase 3 clinical trials, but we don't have any of the phase 3 clinical data yet. And there has been some good information on other treatments. Monoclonal antibodies is probably the most serious breakthrough. Regeneron has released some trial results. That's actually one of the drugs that Trump took, and the trial results have been very promising so far. So that's not a vaccine, but it's a potential therapeutic cure for people who actually have developed symptoms of COVID. We're seeing lower death rates from hospitalizations. I think the standard of care has improved. We've got a number of drugs that have been used, but we should note the virus is still very deadly for the elderly. We don't have a cure, but we do have an improvement in therapeutics here. And we're seeing an increasing reluctance of governments to implement full lockdowns in many countries, even when they're experiencing second waves. You know, society appears to be less fearful than they were. Maybe this is just simply fatigue. When we look at emerging markets, and this is an area that have been a major concern for us in terms of the economic damage and whether we're going to get major runs on the currencies in some key emerging markets is one of the tail risks that could lead to a 50% down. But the emerging markets appear to be more resilient, notwithstanding that the virus is running rampant in many emerging markets. They're leaving their economies open, and the economic downside doesn't seem to be sort of at the very sort of worst case outcomes. Of course, the human tragedy could be enormous in those markets, but the economic downside is probably not as great as we were fearing. We're seeing substantial economic support here, particularly from governments in terms of expenditure and what the central banks have been doing. We've been seeing that in Australia. It's forecast in the United States that the budget deficit is going to be 16% of their national income this year. It's absolutely extraordinary, the amount of stimulus expenditure that's being spent. And what I would say to you in terms of that range of sort of 20 to 50%, 20% up to 50% down, I would say the downside scenarios looks like it's less than it was. So the extreme downside cases appear to be mitigating at the moment as we go further into this. But this is a fluid situation. We're still early into these second waves. We don't yet have the phase 3 trial results. We could have some failures of these vaccines. We're starting to see some evidence of people getting reinfected, which is quite typical for coronaviruses, by the way. But we're starting, there was reports of another reinfection in the United States overnight. But we have been selectively reducing our cash as we're becoming, I guess, more comfortable about the extreme downside scenarios here. But we've been doing it in areas that we think are less exposed to sort of ongoing downside from the pandemic. So we remain cautious, but I think we've tightened our bounds of the extreme downside scenario. So a little bit optimistic, but still cautious, I would say, at the moment.
Thanks, Hamish. And we'll start grabbing some of the questions that, that have come through. We've, again, tried to group them into areas that are of most interest, if you like. And the first one I'm going to kick off is back to the US election. How are global markets likely to react to a Joe Biden win, either with a retained Republican Senate or a new Democratic Senate?
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, if the Republicans retain the Senate, nothing will really happen. It will be gridlocked in Washington, and I think the markets will be delighted with that, with the outcome. But the real issue is whether or not, as I was saying before, whether the Democrats get the trifecta here, and whether or not they're going to remove the filibuster, that key Senate rule. You know, that could certainly spook the markets in terms of what the agenda may be of the Democrats here. Is it going to be a really market unfriendly radical left agenda? I would say that is probably unlikely to be the result, but we could well get some negative reactions from the markets if they get the trifecta in the markets, speculating what may happen. But on the other side, I think very quickly we're going to get a very large stimulus bill out of the Democrats post a Biden win, and I think markets will like that. And I think that's one of the reasons markets are strong at the moment. You know, the opinion polls are really firming in the Democrat favor here, but markets have been strengthening in the last week or so. And I think that's the expectation: you're going to get a large stimulus implemented by the Democrats. They're talking $1.6 trillion. Interest rates are very low. The US Federal Reserve is going to keep interest rates low. And if something goes wrong, I think you'll find the Fed stepping back in and buying more assets under their quantitative easing program. But when you look at the portfolio as a whole in terms of the Democratic win, we do have to be mindful. It's very likely there's going to be an increase in the corporate taxation rate from 21 to 28%. What have we done? We've got less exposure to US businesses, and we would have had 12 months or so ago. We're owning more businesses outside of the United States. The Democrats are probably going to push through further healthcare reform, not just as a direct result of what's going on with this pandemic, but an agenda that came in under Obama to further extend what was known as the Affordable Care Act, and also to probably further regulate drug pricing in the United States. So, you know, you want to be careful around healthcare. We've got very minimal exposure. We've got one healthcare stock in the portfolio, Novartis, that had very modest exposure to that US healthcare risk. There's a very large decarbonisation agenda under the Democrats, and I think they've been very clear. Biden's been very clear. I think you're going to see a lot of investment in the renewables sector. At the end of the day, we're very positively skewed to that happening in the portfolio. We have over 10% of the portfolio now in three US utilities. The utilities are going to be benefited by further investments, because the more they can invest, the higher they will, higher will be their growth rates over time. So some of the utilities in the last week have actually been performing pretty well as these opinion polls have been forming. But we also have to be mindful of technology regulation. We've got large exposures to a few US technology companies. So, you know, we're very carefully monitoring that. But I don't think you should be panicking at all as investors around a Democratic win. But there could be some volatility as markets settle down if they have a very strong win.
Hey, Equity Mates, we're going to interrupt Hamish for a second to quickly hear from our sponsors.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Lots of questions, Hamish, came through about the tensions, trade tensions between China and the US. This question kind of summarises it. Does the decoupling of the US and China make your position in Chinese technology platform businesses more or less appealing?
Frank, this is a great question. Obviously, we've been increasing our exposure to China, and particularly the two large Chinese technology platforms, Alibaba and Tencent, over the last year to 18 months. The first thing I would say is they add diversification to our portfolio. We haven't got all our eggs in the US technology basket here. We're very, very interested in investing in businesses and areas we believe that can grow at very attractive rates in the next 10 plus years. This is difficult. We're in a low growth world. Growth is going to be very hard to find. And the Chinese consumption story, in our view, of the next 10 to 20 years is a strong growth story, despite the current tensions and the debates for decoupling. The rise of China and the consumer side of China, we don't think is going to be fundamentally affected by these tensions between the United States and China. This is one reason we like Starbucks and we like our investment in Estee Lauder, because they are plays on Chinese consumption. Our investments in these Chinese technology platforms, Tencent and Alibaba, are also direct plays on China, but they're not really coupled with the United States. They're both incredible businesses sitting at the intersection of what's really happening in the digital economy. You know, in a way, we may be more concerned with this decoupling debate regarding our investment in Starbucks. We're very comfortable with our investment in Starbucks, but you could actually see that brand in China getting caught up if this gets much deeper, because their business is based in China. Tencent and Alibaba's businesses are not based in the United States. There's nothing really to decouple from, because they have very, very minor parts of their profitability and futures in the United States, and there's relatively limited things that the United States can do to harm their businesses in China at the end of the day. You know, so notwithstanding these tensions and decoupling, we're very comfortable with the technology plays we have in China. There are risks there. There are probably more domestic regulatory risks and other risks associated with China than they are the risks about the decoupling with the United States.
And Hamish, a live question just came through, and I thought it was related, given that you're mentioning Alibaba. The question is, will there be any positive benefits to Magellan that we can take advantage of with a spin-off from Alibaba of Ant Financial? Can you comment on that quickly?
Hey, it's a very good question. Now, Ant Financial is probably going to be the most sought after IPO literally in history. It's probably going to have a valuation of upwards of $300 billion US dollars. It is one of the best business models I've seen in 10 years. It's effectively four businesses within Ant, the Ant Group. One is a payments business, a very, very large payments business, probably facilitating payments in the order of $16 trillion US dollars. It's staggering. They earn small amounts of money on those payments, but they get enormous amounts of data as all those payments are made. And what they're leveraging that data into is effectively three businesses they've got. One is an unsecured lending platform where loans to individuals, you could think of it, it's the credit card platform of China. So when you want to go and shop and you haven't got money, and you want to draw down effectively on a credit card and you don't have a credit card, you can go to the Alipay app and you can be within seconds get effectively an unsecured loan. For that, the Alibaba platform knows who you are. They know all about your data and they effectively tender out that loan to a bank in the area in which you're shopping. And within seconds, you're extended that loan, which you obviously it's going to bear interest. And Alibaba collects slightly over 2.5% of the average daily balance of that loan as a technology fee. So they're not taking any credit risk, but they're connecting the individuals with lenders in the system. It's a very clever and very powerful business model. And they're doing the same thing for small business. And that's called their credit tech platform. They've also got a platform that's called investment tech. It is the funds management platform. So directly on your Alipay app, you can buy investments in mutual funds like Magellan. We don't operate in China, but like Magellan, you could buy the Magellan fund if we operated in China directly on their platform. And Alibaba collects a technology fee of around 60 basis points for equity products in China. It's rapidly growing. There's 700 million consumers on that Alipay app in China at the moment. The last one is an insurance platform where they effectively can originate insurance if you want your car insured or your life insured or health insurance or delivery to be insured from the Alibaba group. You can get insurance online and they're collecting as a commission 15% of the insurance premium. So it's a company that effectively has a royalty over the insurance industry, a royalty over the funds management industry, a royalty over the lending, the unsecured lending industry, and then a massive payments business. So it's a very, very good business. Obviously, we've got a direct exposure or indirect exposure to Alibaba, which is our largest investment. Would we be interested in Ant Group? Yeah, at the right price. It's going to be very, very hard to get shares in that. We're big investors in Alibaba. We understand Ant Group well. So, you know, watch this space. You know, at the right price, if we could get an allocation, we'd be interested. But there's some water to flow under the bridge in terms of the price hasn't been set yet, and it's going to have a lot of investors over the world. This is going to be very, very oversubscribed in our view, notwithstanding it's going to be the largest IPO in history.
Hamish, moving back on to COVID impact, if a vaccine isn't found in the next 12 months, what can we expect?
That's an interesting question. You know, I'll try to dust off this crystal ball here, Frank. It really depends. It depends about how governments and societies react to no vaccine being found. You know, what's going to happen to the healthcare systems if we don't have a vaccine? Will they be overwhelmed? Will the governments, if we don't have a vaccine, be forced to have lockdowns again? But will the standard of care continue to improve? And will mortality rates actually continue to trend downwards even if we don't have a vaccine? You know, if we don't have a vaccine, can we get to herd immunity? Are you going to get reinfected again, or will society naturally start becoming more immune to it without a vaccine? What's going to happen to the borders? Are we going to reopen borders, or will we stay sort of permanently in lockdown to a total herd immunity? Of course, the longer this goes on without immunity in society, and a vaccine is the best way to get immunity in society if it works, but the longer this goes on without immunity in society, the deeper the economic damage is going to be. So if we don't get a vaccine, this is certainly going to increase the economic risk. And what I would say to you is if some of these phase three trials spectacularly fail in reaching their endpoints and we can't actually distribute any of these vaccines that are in development at the moment, you know, that's going to probably be a major dampener for markets. Markets are expecting at least one of these trials is going to be somewhat effective and we're going to start rolling out next year. But that is a great unknown at the moment, Frank.
Let's talk about markets and macro. Why is there such a disconnect between the world economy and the share market?
Yeah, Frank, I often get this question, and you have to remember the share market is a forecast of the future. It's effectively, it's trying to discount all the cash flows of all businesses from now to judgment day and think what's worse. So it's factoring what's happening in the next 12 months, but it's also factoring what's happening in 2 years and 5 years and 10 years and 20 years into the future. Where when you look at the economy, it's really a very static picture. It's really telling you what's happening today. So the unemployment can be terrible and we could have a lot of credit losses, but that's not telling you what the unemployment rates can be in 5 and 10 years into the future. So you often get this disconnect between the picture you see today, which is the economy, and the share market, which is a prediction of the future. And, you know, you ask yourself at any point in time when you see these disconnects of whether or not the market is being irrational. You know, there's so much uncertainty at the moment, but the market has had a very, very strong rally and is close back to its sort of all-time highs. You know, is that completely irrational? And I would say it's reflecting a number of things. It's reflecting the very low interest rates. Interest rates are lower around the world than they were back in February. And that's because the central banks have stepped back in. And of course, the lower the interest rates, the higher valuations can be because the discounted future cash flows are more in a low interest rate world. We've seen an incredible amount of fiscal stimulus and monetary support in the world. And there's probably also a view in markets that with all these trials, a vaccine will be found and we'll start to roll it out in 2021. You know, that last view may or may not be correct. If it's correct, the markets are being rational. But if we can't get any form of vaccine in that time frame, and this is going to run for 2 or 3 more years in terms of dealing with it, the markets may well be ahead of themselves. But it's very usual in periods like this that you do get these disconnects to what you're seeing in the economy today to what the share market's actually valuing, which, as I say, is a view of the future.
But putting the market valuations to one side, we've just had another question come through. Specifically, the holdings in your portfolio, the valuations you're comfortable with.
Yeah, well, yes, we are. We wouldn't be holding things if we weren't comfortable with the valuations. You know, we sold Apple fairly recently because we think it had passed our assessment of a fair value. Obviously, the market disagrees with us, but we think we're very disciplined on valuation in our portfolio. It certainly reflects also our view of where interest rates are headed, which justifies higher valuations than may have been the case five years ago. But yes, we are comfortable with the valuations of the stocks. Some are more fully valued than others in our portfolios. But when they get to points which we think above fair value, we have no hesitation in selling the investments.
This question's interesting, Hamish. What's your most profound observation in the markets over the last 12 months?
Well, I don't think I often have very profound observations on anything, Frank, as you know. But, you know, what I'd say is probably you should never be surprised by what actually happens or how markets react to them. You know, you should expect the unexpected when you're in markets. Events like this have happened in the past and they're going to happen in the future. You know, the scale of the economic damage from the pandemic was unexpected. Did we expect that as a response to a virus that started in sort of December and then January and through February was going to result in a total lockdown of most major economies in the world, that we were going to close our borders and live on prison island where we're not let out again, where we won't be able to travel between states in Australia? I don't think any of us envisaged that. So it was extreme. The scale and willingness of governments to open the expenditure floodgates was also above expectations. I remember early on into this, I gave an interview and suggested that the governments may have to spend 10 to 20% of their national income to cover the lost economic output. And that seemed pretty extreme at the time. But we're seeing countries like Australia and the United States, that's exactly where they've landed. So the response has been, even though I made that suggestion, it didn't really occur to me that it would actually happen, that the governments would spend this amount of money to cover. You know, there's almost been an income surplus in this recession because of the fiscal expenditure. You know, how do we deal with this to expect the unexpected? We want to build resilient portfolios. And that's what we do. So whenever we go to bed at night, we could have another event like this when we wake up in the morning, but I don't lose a lot of sleep over that, because, you know, we really do expect the unexpected. They're going to happen from time to time, and they shouldn't be something to panic you if you're long-term investors.
Hamish, does the rising debt matter if interest rates remain low for a lot longer?
Yeah, this is a very interesting topic today. It looks like governments don't think that it matters, but taken to extreme, of course, it matters. We're even hearing, you know, our own government, and this was a government that was so opposed to the debt and deficits disaster, taking on just extraordinary amounts of debt. And the argument is there's no interest cost from this. You know, interest rates are so low that the interest burden on all this debt is less than it was when debt was much lower and interest rates were higher, and therefore taking on this is almost free. And if you take this to the extreme, why wouldn't we just get rid of all taxation, make tax zero, and governments just borrow the money? Of course, that isn't sustainable to believe in this. And this even has a name now. It's called modern monetary theory, that when interest rates are very low or zero, you can effectively borrow money with no cost, and you're better to borrow the money and just spend it because it's never going to have a cost to you. But of course, there will be a day of reckoning. Just because interest rates are super low today, you cannot assume they will always be low. And if you believe debt is free and debt has no consequences, you might as well believe in the tooth fairy. One day inflation will come back, and one day interest rates will have to increase. But this period we're in could actually last for a very, very long period of time. And what worries me, the problem is the longer this goes on, more and more politicians may start believing in the tooth fairy. And because they have relatively short election cycles, what are the restraints on them just to spend the money today and believe in it's just a free lunch? But ultimately there'll be a day of reckoning. So I hope there are some rational voices at the table. I think it's been prudent in this last 6 months that governments have been aggressive in their response to the situation we're facing. But to think politicians can just spend money with no consequences in the future, I think future generations are going to have a lot to bear. I'm not being critical of what's happening at the moment. I just hope this trend doesn't get too much momentum.
So, Hamish, not unrelated, a question has just come through asking about your view on whether inflation is likely to return or not, and why you have that view.
Yeah, I think we're in a period of low inflation for a very extended period of time. You know, we'd had a massive long economic recovery since 2009, and we didn't see any evidence of inflation. And there's a whole series of reasons why that's occurring. We have excess capacity in the world's system. We have fundamental demographic changes happening in many countries, which forces increased savings in society. Productivity has been falling. So I think there's a lot of reasons why we're in this cycle, particularly post this pandemic. I think we've probably got a larger sort of excess capacity in the world's system. So we're probably going to get a very extended period of low inflation. But that doesn't mean we're always going to have low inflation, Frank. No. At the end of the day, and you know these go in cycles. We could be in a long-term cycle of low inflation, but assuming that's going to last forever, and therefore we can do very reckless things in this environment, particularly with monetary policy, at the end of the day it may come back to bite us. So am I worried about inflation in the next 5 years? No, I'm not worried about inflation in the next 5 years. But if inflation comes back, it will be very, very bad for markets, because central banks will have to respond with rising interest rates, and rising interest rates are the enemy of markets. But I think we're in a low inflation, low rate world for the period ahead. But we're also thinking about ultimately the risks to that and inflation, and wanting to make sure we also have some inflation protection in our longer term thinking of how we're allocating assets.
So given that that view on rates lower for longer, I mean, where do you see the biggest impact for such a long period?
Yeah, well, you really think about interest rates and why they're low, and you have to ask, they're a result of this sort of low economic growth and low inflation period. You know, low interest rates have a one-off uplift in valuations by reduction in the discount or interest rate. But in the long term, once you've lowered interest rates, you know, equities should reflect the underlying income growth. So we've had a benefit of equities sort of being turbocharged in the last sort of 10 years as interest rates have continued to fall, and we've had another step down in the last 6 months. But as I say, that is a one-off effect. You know, moving forward after that one-off effect of reducing interest rates, if we're in this environment, it probably means we're in a low growth and low inflation environment, which means incomes are going to grow more slowly. Profitability is going to grow more slowly in aggregate. And that's going to be a very difficult environment for investors to navigate. They can't simply put their money in the bank and earn any interest income on that. And without interest rates going further down, equity returns are probably going to have to reflect these very low growth rates and low growth in profitability, which means you're going to have to be very selective moving forward, and you're going to have to really find some reliable growth in this world. And that's what we're seeking to do at Magellan. We're trying to find where the reliable growth in the world, in this world which low interest rates are telling you we're probably going to have very low growth and we're going to have low inflation. So how do you navigate around that world but still earn people decent returns on their investments?
Hey, Equity Mates, quickly interrupting Hamish here to have a quick breather and hear from our sponsors.
Nice and topical, Hamish. What's your medium-term outlook for FANG versus BAT? And just let me define BAT. BAT apparently is Baidu, Alibaba and Tencent. I think people know what FANG is, but there's BAT.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting that you frame the question, or who's asked the question has termed it FANG versus BAT. I don't really regard this as sort of a one versus the other. They're subject to quite different risks, the big tech platforms in China in particular versus the US tech platforms. You know, many of these companies are very highly advantaged businesses. I would say that most of these, Baidu, I probably wouldn't put in this camp, but most of these companies are the most powerful business models we've literally seen in the last 100 years. You probably have to go back to the railroad barons back 100 years ago. There are very, very strong network effects in place in these businesses, and they're very light in terms of the capital usage, probably outside of Amazon here. And I call this sort of capitalism without capital. It is truly extraordinary. You know, if you look at the FANG, they are really global plays, ex-China, on e-commerce, digital advertising, cloud computing, entertainment, particularly video streaming if you take Netflix. If you look at the big Chinese tech platforms, actually they play in China, but they're broader. They're even broader than the FANG are. They're plays on e-commerce, digital advertising, cloud computing, entertainment, which includes gaming, video and music. They're very on the digitalization of enterprise processes. They're into payments, financial disintermediation. They're into local services like delivery. So those platforms are even broader than the FANG in the United States. States, but all these companies are incredibly advantaged. They're of course going to attract the attention of regulators when they're in this position. We like to diversify our play, but I don't regard that, oh, you should be in the Chinese platforms or you should be in the US ones. You know, all of these companies are extraordinary. The real question is, what are the risks and what are they worth? You know, we want to buy them when we think they're They're trading at less than we think they're worth taking the risk into account, but we're also wanting to diversify those risks. But it's not a FANG versus BAT. It's all of them are extraordinary in their own ways.
So, again, conscious of time, Hamish, there was a question here. Could you please discuss the social dilemma given our investments in Alphabet, Google and Facebook?
Well, The Social Dilemma is actually an important documentary. It's recently been released on Netflix, and if people haven't watched it, I would encourage you. If you're just interested in investing, I do think it raises some very important issues, and it's really on the power of the social networks in particular, particularly very focused on Facebook in the United States. It touches on part of Google's business as well. The documentary is very, very focused on the social harm that comes from these platforms. It's really talking about, you know, what they do to keep the users engaged on their platforms, like sending you notifications that ping on your phone, you pick your phone up and go back and look at your Facebook, who said something. It's also about their recommendation and news feeds and how they're doing that and how they can reinforce sort of prejudices in society but keep showing you the stuff you want to read and maybe not getting alternative, more balanced views. It's not surprising that platforms are using algorithms and things trying to get users engaged on their platforms for as long as they can. You know, that's what capitalism is. You're trying to, you know, any shopping centre wants you in their shopping centre as long as they can keep you in their shopping centres. And these are very important issues. I would say that the documentary doesn't actually provide any solutions. And very importantly, I don't think balances really the social good that has come from these platforms as well. It's not a one-way street of bad. There is very important social inclusions of in connecting with your friends, connecting with your family, but very important in connecting with interest groups, and particularly if you had a child who had a rare disease or something, finding other families around the world who are going through the same issue. So there is a lot of benefits that come from social inclusion of these platforms. And, you know, the platforms, they've actually changed their algorithms that, of course, got people more engaged, but they've actually changed their algorithms from time to time to stop people just watching videos and other factors. I think it's an important question to get the balance right. You know, many of these platforms are still young here. What we have to think about as investors, do documentaries like The Social Dilemma, are they going to cause a knee-jerk reaction from politicians in particular to put probably not well thought through sort of regulatory responses in relation to this because the general public becomes concerned? Of course, we're watching that very, very carefully. I'm, you know, quite confident, I'm kind of an optimistic person, that we will find the right balance. We will get more regulations on privacy. We will get more regulations on content and penalise the platforms when they get it wrong, and they will find a balance. We don't think these platforms are going to be outlawed and closed down completely, but there are issues that as these things grow up and they develop, these questions have to be asked, and therefore it's a very important documentary. It's making us think about the risk as well in relation to these investments, but it's well worth watching if you haven't watched it, The Social Dilemma on Netflix.
So, Hamish, are you concerned with increasing regulatory kind of oversight and involvement and its impact on our platform holdings?
Yeah, well, what I'd say is whenever you get these sort of near monopoly businesses like these that are very, very large in their nature, of course you're going to attract the attention of regulators. This is particularly around the risk predominantly of our US platform investments, Alphabet that owns Google and Facebook. It's also going to attach Amazon and Apple that we're not owning at the moment, but really Alphabet and Facebook, you know, they're probably 12% of our portfolio. So you need to put in context, there's risk around here. The risks facing Alphabet and Facebook are somewhat different. You know, Alphabet's more around sort of antitrust issues about preferring their own services on their own platforms. Facebook are very much around the issues we talked around, particularly around content on their platform and who's responsible for that. Both of them have antitrust. They've made acquisitions in the past. They're quite different to the risks facing the Chinese technology platforms. It could be gaming risks if you're in Tencent in China. What we think is important to actually have exposed to different risks and making sure that you're appropriately diversified between the different risks. You know, the United States is attempting to ban WeChat, which is the social platform, the messaging platform of Tencent in the United States. We're not overly concerned. That's just simply not material to the Tencent investment case. You know, we've talked about the Facebook risks. The one we're watching very closely is the regulation of content, and both sides of the political aisles have the opposing views on this. You know, the Republicans want complete free speech, and therefore you should be able to say whatever you want on this platform. And of course, the Democrats don't like extreme speech or things that aren't true, and want them to take down sort of very right-wing speech on that. So it's a very difficult problem to solve. We do huge amounts of due diligence on these specific risks attaching to the different companies, particularly in Europe and in the United States. The good thing is a lot of these risks are very visible. There's a lot of public debate. You're not going to suddenly wake up one morning and see a piece of legislation you've never seen before. That's not how the legislative process works. We think we're in a solid position to evaluate the risk. We continue to believe these companies are attractive investments despite this risk. And as I say, we've got these risks diversified within the portfolio. But you can't own these great companies near monopolies without getting regulatory risk, and you have to evaluate that risk.
So a question here, does Magellan's long-term thesis of 9% growth target still hold true given everything that's occurred post the pandemic?
Frank, this is a really, really good question. You know, overall markets returns have been above profit growth, and that's because of the falling interest rates we've seen. As Warren Buffett has described, interest rates are the gravity of markets. You lower interest rates and everything goes up in value. You lift interest rates and down they will go in value. As I was stating before, we're probably seeing the benefit of falling interest rates. Maybe it's not 100% reflected if rates stayed at these levels, but a lot of the reduction in interest rates have been reflected in market valuations here, which probably means that moving forward, in the absence of rates going even lower, you know, world profitability is not going to grow anywhere near 9% per annum. We're probably going to be in a very low growth world for the next decade. And therefore, we're probably going to have equity returns in aggregate materially below 9% per annum. And you ask yourself, well, how are we going to set that target if the bar's got higher, if it's got tougher? And all I'd say to you is we're running a concentrated portfolio. We're looking for very unique sources of growth in the portfolio. And the simple answer is we're not going to lower the bar just because it's got harder. You know, we're going to stick with the target. We think we can achieve the target. But there's no guarantees of that. I don't want people sort of running away and thinking they're going to get 9% per annum. It will be judged over a full investment cycle, sort of 7 years, not over sort of a six-month period. But when you do things in a concentrated fashion, you can very selectively where you want to invest, we still feel comfortable that you can do it in that type of portfolio. But markets in aggregate delivering 9% per annum over the next decade, I think that's a real stretch unless we get into a real world of negative rates.
There's a question just come through, Hamish. Where do retirees find self-funded retirees find income from investments when interest rates are so low and there are some dividends being cut and diminished? Do you have a view on that?
Yeah, all I would say is probably have some caution here. The typical thing you do when you can't get any return very sort of, you know, conservative assets like a bank deposit or maybe a bank hybrid is to go into more risky investments. And I think there will be a lot of promoters who come up with some very fancy investments that sound good and going to deliver you income. I'd put your hat on and ask if you really understand what they're trying to sell you. Often these sort of investments are illusory. Really, a lot of the income is manufactured. It's not real. And you're probably taking on more risk. So it's a tough one. I can't say it's easy. We're in the not too distant future, we're planning to release a new retirement product that is trying to answer part of this question. People are going to have to take a bit more equity risk, but also we're trying to mitigate that risk in the product. But I don't have a simple solution. But I'd be careful about just reaching for income and going down the risk spectrum too much here. It's a difficult world to be in here in terms of getting income out of sort of fixed income products without taking a lot of sort of credit risk and other risk on in your portfolios. I wish I had a simple answer for people. I don't. I think it's a challenging world we're entering.
Well, hopefully quality managed funds have a place in that self-funded retiree strategy, Hamish. There is one interesting one that just came through that I thought we'd cover off. How has COVID-19 and the lack of international travel impacted your ability to effectively assess potential investment opportunities, not being able to meet with management? I just thought that was interesting. How do you
I think it's a really good question, actually. It's been a really interesting learning period. We've actually found when we haven't been able to travel, we've had more frequent and deep engagement on Zoom and Microsoft Teams with management. I'm asking our analysts to ask senior management to join us on video conferences quite frequently. We're getting chief executives of some of the largest companies in the world, and we're now inviting maybe 16 people from Magellan to those meetings. That the discussions tend to be very timely. They're contemporaneous with what's occurring, because the executives, just like many people on this call, before COVID happened, I think most people, if we said join a Zoom call, they would have thought we were talking about going in the car or something. They wouldn't have joined the call because they weren't used to it. But now, because executives are doing this day-to-day life, they're going, yeah, sure, no problems. We'll set up an hour for a call. But now I'm bringing 16 people to the meeting. I could not turn up to a meeting in New York and say, do you mind coming to your conference room and I'm bringing 16 colleagues with me? But also, I would have had to take 16 people probably out of the office for 1 week and spend all the money on the airfares and everything else. So what I'm finding is we're actually getting more frequent contact, probably more timely contact, and deeper contact with more of our people in this world than we were when we're traveling. I'm not saying we will never travel again, because there are certain relationships you build and other things that are done in a face-to-face world. But I think we're going to be better off. I think because of this changing work environment, we're going to be more deeply engaged with companies. We'll be more frequently engaged with them, because we just won't be lying on a trip. But visiting them physically is going to be important as well. But to date, it hasn't been a negative. It's actually we've learned some really positive things from the engagement.
So Hamish, just in the last minute or two that we've got, do you have any advice for younger advisors who are fairly new to the industry and navigating this pandemic early in their careers?
Well, the first thing I would say is expect the unexpected. This isn't the first sort of shock you're going to see in your careers. If you stay in this industry or as an investor or an advisor and you're young and you see something like this, it's very important you stay the course. Investing is a long-term business. It's not determined over 3 or 6 months. It's determined over years and years and years. It's all about finding the right businesses and the right investments, and investments that you believe can compound your wealth at a decent clip over a long period of time. You know, if you find very decent businesses that you're very confident in their long-term prospects, you can largely ignore these short-term issues like we've seen in the last 6 months. You know, when you find a great company with great long-term prospects, you know, you can largely sit on your backside. I know it doesn't seem that exciting for people who want to trade in and out of things every moment, but great wealth is built out of compounding. It's not built out of trading at the end of the day. My best advice to somebody who's young in the game is understand the power of compound interest. As a young person, you have a major advantage over the vast majority of people on this call, and your advantage is your age. You have more time to do it, and time is super valuable in this game. As Benjamin Franklin famously said, he's one of the founding fathers of the United States of America. He was actually a very good investor and inventor. And his quote on compound interest said, money makes money, and the money that money makes makes more money. And that's what investing is all about. It's about finding the right investments and letting them work for you over the long term and not get caught up in this short-term noise like this election coming up in the United States or the pandemic occurring at the moment. Great businesses will compound your wealth over time.
Thanks, Hamish.
It's a pleasure, Frank.
And thanks, everyone, for watching this this live Zoominar. We'll be posting a recording of the webinar on our website in case you want to forward it on to colleagues and friends. You're more than welcome to. It'll also feature in our quarterly update, which is going out on Thursday. And in particular, for advisors and stockbrokers who want to claim some CPD points, again, you're able to do that via Thursday's investor letter. Separately, we'll be responding, trying to respond to the many questions that we weren't specifically able to address. We'll be in contact over the next few days. Please stay safe, and thanks again, Hamish, and everyone for joining us. Thank you.
Hey, Equity Mates, Bryson Wren again. We hope you enjoyed that interview from Magellan's Chief Investment Officer, Hamish Douglas. We certainly did, and we certainly learned a lot from it, so hope you guys did as well.
Absolutely. And just a quick reminder that at the start of this week, our Get Started Investing ETFs for Beginners series went live, where we sat down with the experts from BetaShares to unpack all there is to know about ETFs when you are starting your investing journey, everything from the basics through to understanding how to find the right ETF for you. And then also importantly, what to do once you've bought, the administrative side of things and managing your portfolio. So head over to our Get Started Investing feed to listen to that series. We had a great time recording it, but also if you would like to watch it on YouTube, it is available. So head over to our YouTube channel, Equity Mates Investing Podcast, to check it out there. Wren, that's a wrap. We'll chat next week.
Nice one. Sounds good.
Thanks for listening to Equity Mates Investing Podcast, a production of Equity Mates Media. Please remember that everything you hear in Equity Mates Investing Podcast is general advice only. The content has been prepared without knowing your personal objectives, specific financial circumstances, or goals. The host of Equity Mates Investing Podcast may maintain positions in the companies discussed. Before considering any investment, please read the product disclosure statement and consider speaking to a licensed financial professional.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With the McDonald's app, you can get your favorite thing delivered to your door. So if you are looking for a reason to skip washing those dishes you left in the sink, consider this a sign. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Right now, get $0 delivery fee with any purchase of $15 or more, only in the app. At participating McDonald's, minimum purchase excludes tax and service fees. Delivery prices may be higher than in restaurants. Other fees may apply, not valid with any other offer, discount, or coupon.